to Minority Corner
with an Eke
and James,
the Wonder Twins of podcasting.
Learn, laugh, play.
It's like Blue's Clues,
only it's more black, queer,
and ladylike.
This week on Minority Corner,
what are you cooking?
Aneke, I got some jury stew cooking up in this kitchen for you. A stir, ooh, stir, stir, because you know
is
what?
Is it delicious or
these
is it
juries
bitter?
Stink? Okay, so that's what this smell is. You smell that? It's some stank ass juries.
Am I excited to taste this stew? No, but I'm excited to hear about how you made it.
Exactly. I'm gonna teach you all. There's a lot of dirty ass nasty facts, which are the ingredients into this stew, about why juries be stinking it up. And then I'm gonna tell you about my own stank ass jury experience. Am I selling it to you? I just got so bitter.
I think so.
But essentially going to be getting you to just bunkering down on the importance of why woke-ass folks need to be serving on those juries. Everyone's got inconveniences, but you being inconvenienced for a day or so could save someone's life.
I love it. That's great. I'm going to be doing a little quickie history corner about another black lady tennis legend that you might not have heard of, Althea Gibson.
What? Who's she?
You'll find out.
Okay. All right. Ooh. And I think we both saw Crazy Rich Asians, so let's definitely talk about that.
Yes.
And I saw Janet, and I have notes. I saw her in Harlem. I have notes.
Yeah. Don't forget, Trump.
Oh,
was criticized by Tupac.
What?
When? Now? In the past? Who knows?
He a magical man. He a magical man on the island. Well, I can't wait for you to drop the dish on us. Shall we get into it, my lady love?
Let's do it.
Hey, hey, hey.
Hey, James. How's it going?
Living my best life.
That's awesome.
Yeah. How you doing over there on the West Coast? The
you
best
know,
coast.
It's hanging out. Just, you know, the last dredges of summer.
Yes.
So what's been going on with you?
There's a really great thing and then a really not so great thing happened.
Okay.
Which one do you want first?
Give me a toss-up. Let's do really great.
Okay, well, I saw Crazy Rich Asians and it was fucking amazing.
Oh, I love that movie. I saw it too.
Ah, so great. I feel like two of like my favorite movies of the year, and I think they were going to be box office bonanzas, Black Panther and Crazy Rich Asians, which are going to do so wonderfully globally, are just like proving myths that Hollywood had going on, that like you had to only cast white people.
Yeah, I mean, like the crazy thing is, like, so many studios wanted to change the lead of Crazy Rich Asians to a white woman,
to a white girl.
And like I think the author optioned the book for $1. I could be wrong, but I heard this, just so he could make sure that it would be played in theaters and not streaming. So like a lot of rigmarole.
It was up for a deal, $1 billion deal with Netflix, and they like turned it down because they, like you said, they wanted it to be distributed to movie theaters. Is there something more magical about when something is out in theaters? They said that it has it more of like a museum feeling. There's a certain caliber that your movie automatically becomes just by going into theaters.
Yeah, definitely. That's like, I mean, there's, of course, there's something about going to the theater. Like,
sure,
it's an event. It turns into an event, and it turns into a movement. People get to band together to support a movie. I mean, look what happened with Black Panther. I was so excited to go to Crazy Rich Asians. Like, you know, like we each have to support our films when they're out there, you know?
Totally.
Like, just because I'm a black woman, you know? Like, so what? I'm going to support a movie that has a full cast of Asian and Asian American actors. Like, that is monumental, and it's a shame that it's monumental right now. So
the last time I saw that was Better Luck Tomorrow. Did you ever see that? It was an MTV Films movie. It was released nationwide, but it was done by like MTV Films. I think it had, what's this guy's name?
I don't know.
Star Trek.
Oh, John Cho.
John Cho, yes, yeah, he was in it. And I remember when I was a teen watching that movie, I thought, like, oh my God, like, things are going to change now. You're going to see Asian Americans in films. And that just didn't even happen after that. And that was like back in like the 90s.
I know. And before that was Joy Luck Club. So it's like, it's rare and few between. And it's really annoying that it's that way. So, and on top of it, it's a really fucking good movie.
It's so good. I mean, put all that aside, it's like, it's so fucking good. Yeah. Like, I didn't know a romantic comedy could be that fucking good. Like, take notes, everybody. And even like black folks writing romantic comedies, like, we got to step it up a notch. Because this was just, it was just a good film. It was good storytelling.
Yeah, so I highly encourage people to go see it. I mean, if you want to have fun, and it's beautiful, they must have spent a gabillion dollars on this movie because it's just like dripping in eye candy. Like, well, the scenery, the costumes, the cast
is gorgeous. Hot.
Yeah, it's just hot, like, hot. I mean, the costumes alone. So, yeah. Like, that is, if you just want to like have a weekend treat, like, there's a lot of movies to go to where you go and you cry and you feel sad and like, ooh, like, sometimes this is a true escape movie. Like, I truly escaped.
Well, and yeah, you know what, and too, like, but I also found it was such, it was very grounded, like, which is like, it's in this like fantastic rich world, and I thought, how could I possibly connect to it? But the characters are so well written that I felt like the stakes, like, I feel like with some rom-coms, they're just so sort of outlandish or ridiculous, but I felt like the sort of plot turns, they were so human, and I could really connect with them. I was like, oh, that kind of reminds me of when I was dating a really, really rich, you know, Jewish guy, and the reason why I wasn't getting along with his mother, like, I could relate to it and connect to it on such a human level. You know, it didn't seem, it was, the set pieces were really grand, but I felt like, I don't know, the family interactions were very human. I was like, oh, that's like my big ass family.
Yeah, I mean,
minus the millions of dollars.
I don't come from a big family. I'm not rich and I've never dated a rich person, but the like intersectionality of it, like being like the whole Asian American versus Asian, like we all, especially Americans, like this is a country of immigrants with the exception of the Native Americans. Like we have the duality, you know, like I've been to Jamaica and haven't really felt like a Jamaican there, you know. I'm sure if I were to go to Africa, I wouldn't necessarily feel like an African, even though an African-American. So yeah, it really drives home that point of the duality of what it means to have this like double identity and being accepted and not because of that. So I thought that that was like, yeah, the grounding, interesting kind of part. And the satire of wealth was like funny too.
Absolutely, yeah. Yep, absolutely. Well, coming from a big family, I will say that's how big families, they definitely are. I wish we had the money that they had. But yeah. One day that's happening. So yeah, oh, and like it's a fucking trilogy. So I'm like, yes, please. Oh, I want to go back to this world.
Like, for sure, there's another one coming out. Are you kidding me? Like after all the like big brouhaha. Oh, and the best part about it, it came out at the same time as competing against Mark Wahlberg.
I was going to say the same thing. It trounced Mark Wahlberg's new movie, which is supposed to be a franchise, and nobody went to go see it.
But that's a good thing though, because Mark Wahlberg, a lot of people don't know this, but in his youth, him and his crew
to use the N-word, right?
They beat up an Asian kid.
Oh, that's what that they was. Oh, look at that.
Yeah. So they beat up an Asian kid and they kind of got away with it, and it's never been called to front, and it was a total hate crime. It was a complete and total hate crime, and he's never really faced repercussions of it. So it is delicious that his film got beat by an all-Asian cast. So that's like the biggest thing.
Yep. That's like sweet, sweet karmatic cinematic justice. And also to just rant, like, there is the hot Asian men up in this movie, and the hot Asian eye candy is so important to have, because like you don't get to see that a lot, especially like in Hollywood movies. And again, like what we see, like Hollywood tells us like who's attractive. Like we've been having to fight against all these sort of things.
Right.
And that like on statistically on dating apps, like Asian women are the most sought after, and that Asian men tend to be the least sought after. So it's great that like this movie is just going to be like pushing boundaries, and there's young girls who are going to be able to see themselves up on that screen. And like I got to go to the movies, and it was packed with mostly like Asian folks up in the theater, and I thought, I was like, oh, this is what it was like for me going to see Black Panther. And it felt so amazing to see that theater and be a part of that experience this past weekend.
Definitely. I loved it. Go see it. We're not getting paid by them, so go see it.
Yeah, this is just like our own thoughts and opinions. On a not like so great note, and you would think that it would be a great note, because I'm going to tell you that I saw Janet Jackson in Harlem.
Oh, okay. So what happened?
Well, she has a new dance track called Made for Now, which is fucking phenomenal and so amazing. And she tore it up on Jimmy Fallon. I don't know if you saw it. Did you get a chance to see her performance in Jimmy Fallon?
No, but I watched her video.
Okay. Her performance on Jimmy Fallon is like fucking amazing. She's so, she sings live and dances. I just am so like, she's just such a treasure.
Yeah, she's
52 years old. Mm-hmm. She's just so fucking phenomenal. And I was getting my hair cut in Harlem, and then I found out my barber was like, Janet's going to be at the, there's a Harlem Week Festival. And they're like, Janet's going to be there at the Harlem Week Festival. I'm like, awesome. Okay, well, let me go get my gym on. I'm going to head on over there.
Yeah.
And linked up with some of my friends who are going to be over there as well. And I have some notes for just organizers and attendees.
Okay.
It's a free ass concert, so everyone like chill the fuck out. Like people were like, so it's supposed to start at 4:30, and then it was getting past 4:30, and people were getting all grumbly. I'm like, y'all didn't pay to see Janet. Like, how's everybody getting all grumbly about like all this stuff?
Right.
She's a legend. I've been to a Janet concert before. Sometimes she takes a little time to like come on out.
Okay.
So then there's that. But then after a while, it was getting to like, they were just playing a lot of Janet tracks. But then it got to be like 5:30, and I was like, okay,
oh, that's getting really late.
Right. But then, but here's the thing. I don't think any of this is Janet's fault. I think it was just poor organizing and miscommunication of what the event was supposed to be.
Oh.
Yeah. So then they start around 5:30. They're like, all right, now we're going to do a pre-show. And pre-show, you usually want to start like before the 4:30 time start.
Right,
or
yeah,
like
3:30.
Start it at 4:30, right? Like, because people are already there. Okay, oh, we're getting a pre-show before Janet comes out. And they had her choreographer come out, and they're like, now her choreographer, who's from New York, is going to teach you some choreography from the music video. And everybody started booing her, and I'm like, oh my God,
oh
you guys.
Oh my God, rude.
This poor woman who's from New York, they're like,
yeah,
boo,
the boo,
we don't
is
care.
Like unnecessary.
Boo. And then you look up at the clouds, you're like, oh shit, it could rain like any minute. Like, again, New York summers. And then, like, so then they brought on, like, and then they kept bringing people on stage and off stage, but nothing was really happening. Mm. There'd be, like, 20 people on stage, and you're just like, okay, any minute, something's going to happen. And it's a tiny stage, so you're thinking, like, is Janet really going to perform?
Uh-huh.
Did Janet ever say she was going to perform? Like, I don't think that's what she was ever going to happen, but somehow it got billed as Janet's going to perform on this tiny-ass stage.
Oh.
And then they brought out, like, 18 kids onto the stage, right? Now, I believe that children are the future, but I feel like I saw a PSA for why we need to fund our after-school arts programs.
Well,
because
wait, how old were they?
They're teenagers.
Okay.
Like, I think there's a certain level of, like, I think when they're six and they're just trying, that's cute. But I feel like when you're, like, a teen, it's like, y'all gotta get this shit together. Because these teenagers came out and they were, like, They're like, Janet, we have a special surprise for you. They were going to have a performance. Okay. And they made Janet stand over on the side of the stage
so
and
she
watch
was
this
there.
Perform. She was there. She came out. And then they wouldn't let her, like, they wouldn't let her talk. She had a microphone. Everyone just wanted to hear her talk. And, like, Janet comes out. And they're like, all right, Janet, we have a surprise for you. These school youth are going to perform for you. Mm. And then they performed. And they did, like, they were doing Rhythm Nation.
Uh-huh.
Now, the first two counts, they were on it.
Okay.
They were hitting it for the first two counts. And then it just fell apart. And Rhythm Nation is a long song.
Yeah, it is.
It's 5.5 minutes.
They did the whole song.
They did the whole song. I'm like, no. We need to fund these after-school arts programs because there could have been someone there to, like, tighten it up a bit or something. And then they had, like, 8 kids singing along with it on a karaoke track version.
Oh.
But they didn't know the words. They didn't know all the words.
No.
They started making up their own words and then forgetting the words that they were making.
In front of Janet Jackson.
And that's what I'm saying. She's like on the stage having to also watch this.
Oh,
and these
rough.
Poor kids are having to do this in front of Janet and in front of an audience who's already been waiting there for like an hour who just doesn't want to, like, they just wanted to see Janet perform because they thought that was going to happen.
This
so,
is wildness.
Mess. And then they were like presenting her with like these plaques. The MTA was like presenting her with a plaque.
What? And get out of here, public transportation.
It was like all these like people just want to get on the mic and be like punny. They were like, funny how time flies when you're organizing a Rhythm Nation to take us on an escapade. It's all for you. Watch out for that black cat.
No.
Like just listing Janet songs and trying to give her an award and listing her 104 awards.
She does not care.
It was a mess. So
she just came there to perform and to get her new song out.
Well, I think she wasn't even there to perform. I think she was just there to actually, like, they were going to hand her an award.
Did she not perform?
No, she didn't perform at all. I don't think she was ever supposed to perform. I don't know.
What?
Yeah, so, and then it started downpouring, so then everybody just, like, left in the middle of, like, why they're, and then their umbrellas up, so you couldn't really see what was happening.
This is a mess. Oh, my God. It was.
So, PSA, we got to put the money into those after-school programs, because those kids, you know, they need us.
It just sounds like Harlem needs to get their act together with their free concerts.
Well, and I think, like, part of it was that Janet, she filmed her new music video in Harlem, and so she was back here.
Okay.
And she also, I guess, used to go to classes, like, she used to go to some Harlem center for arts kids or something. But I'm sure she's, like, on that stage looking at those kids being like, that's not the school program I went to.
Oh,
that's not the classes I took.
That's sad. And I mean, I don't want to, like, knock on teenage or kids because I just feel bad because they're kids. But if you're going to perform in front of the person
Janet?
Who it is,
yes, that's
learn
what
the
I'm
lyrics.
Saying. And like also just like setting these kids up for success of like you want them to have a successful performance because you know what, that shit could be traumatizing when like someone made them get up on stage, they were not prepared, they were not set up for success to be in front of this audience that was ready to boo them at the go.
Or even like some people aren't dancers, some people aren't singers, and that's fine, that is me. And so like, you know, set those kids up for success with like, but I'm just listen, like, if you aren't a strong dancer, you can find dance moves that will make you look good, that like simple beats that you can do. If you're not a singer, you can at least hit one note. So then you hit that one note when it's your time to hit that note. Like, set these kids up for success. It is not the kids' fault. And I'm glad that you are not putting
it
on the
kids. Fault.
It is an adult who is in charge.
That's what I'm saying. We need to fund these programs. And they were passing the mic. There was like three microphones for the eight kids to sing around. And they were just like passing the mic around and like, okay, you try now. And now you try.
Kids,
and Janet's like standing right up
whoever
there.
Whoever was in charge, adult,
and, like,
I'm mad
also,
at you.
Exactly. Well, also, too, it's like, if I know my kids got a performance, like, I'm making sure my kids are drilling their songs, drilling their numbers. Like, that's how my parents did. Like, when I was in Nine on Time back in that talent show, my mom had me practicing and rehearsing.
You set your kids up for success.
And so I caveat, I know Aneke as Aneke is a dancer, in my opinion.
Oh,
I've seen
that was just
I've
an example. I'm
I've
not,
choreographed
Aneke
in
this.
Many a piece. And like Aneke, you practice, you wouldn't just go on stage and be like, I'm ready. Practice your number.
Yeah. And also you were seeing me as I was granted a very young adult, but I was an adult at the time too.
Yeah.
So, you know, it just, I feel very bad about those, adults who set those kids up for disaster in front of
Janet Jackson, and she had to watch the whole thing.
So crazy. Mm. Well, I just wanted to pull up something that I thought was really interesting that I was perusing around the internet found.
What happened on the internet?
Did you know that Tupac Shakur in 1992, so someone had the foresight. A lot of people like to call him Machiavelli because of that album that he had, and maybe he was a little bit more Machiavelli than we gave him credit for,
and that he's still alive and on an island
could be because he in a 1992 interview with MTV criticized Trump.
Wow. Before we even knew to really criticize him as heavily as we are.
When people were like still into Trump, like when they're like, ooh, he was a businessman, ooh, whatever.
He was like in Home Alone 2 around that time.
Yeah, exactly. Like he was just like a businessman. So like I thought it was really kind of interesting that Tupac said, he's quoted in saying, you want to be like Trump, gimme, 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 push, 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 step, 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 crush, crush, crush. That's how it all is. Like, legitimately he said that, and so he went on to go on and talk about economic justice by saying, if this is truly a melting pot, then we really need to be like that, and it needs to be the black kids, and if there's a white person who got money, then he need to help them. He needs to help black kids, Mexican kids, Korean kids, whatever, but it needs to be real. Even if you if you earn it, you still owe it. And I feel like this is a huge point that I really have, it's been resonating with me, because a lot of people have been talking about like healthcare. Ooh, why can't we have like universal healthcare is bad. No, like we have the means to help everybody here. So why, what's wrong with that, you know? And
yeah,
he really gets to the core issue of how we kind of got to this point is yeah, just like the gimme, 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 push, 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 step, 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 and crush, crush, crush. That's literally what's happening right now. You know, mm-hmm, like people are climbing to the top of the ladder, crushing, stepping on people to get up there. And I just thought that was like really interesting that he said this in 1992. And you know, referring to Trump by name,
yeah,
and the state of affairs where we're at right now. So just a reminder, yeah, go vote in November.
Good point. Well, and also too, to your point, you know, and people say like, oh, healthcare, like how would we possibly pay for this healthcare or this free college? It's like, there's a lot of ways you can, yeah, take money. You can take money out of the billions of dollars that we're putting into the military and put, yes, it towards things like education and put it towards healthcare. And you know what? We would still have the largest, strongest military in the world. No one funds their military the way that we have over the last like few decades. In fact, Trump, he just recently, I don't know if you heard about this, but he wanted to have like a military parade.
Yeah, I heard about that bullshit.
Because he saw the one that France did and he was like, well, we need to have one, which is terrifying for like, yes, this dictator type man, yeah, wanting to have a military. The optics on it look terrifying. And then it got canceled because it just was going to cost like 96 million or something. And then he, right, tried to blame like the black female mayor, that it, what, was her fault. And she was like, these are the real like prices. Like, this is what is like the truth of it. And it's like,
yeah.
And then Trump was like, well, I guess now we can go buy a new fighter jet.
Oh,
like,
my God. Really?
That's where you're going to put the money for what would have been that, you know, military parade. You're going to put it towards a fucking fighter jet. Like, we need another fucking fighter jet.
Like, literally what you just said was gimme, 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 step, step, step. Like, he's like, yep, gimme, gimme, gimme. I want the parade. Oh, I can't have the parade. Ooh, I want the fighter jet. And stepping, blaming the fucking person that he can easily blame, a black, yeah, woman, mm, who happens to be the mayor, getting in his way. It's just like, look at these patterns. They are the same ass patterns since the beginning of this country. Like, yeah, and it's kind of ridiculous to me how we just keep repeating the same patterns over and over again. So if it was obvious to Tupac back in 1992,
yeah,
it should be even more obvious to all of us right now, because
yeah,
literally,
foresight,
yeah, Trump is right up there doing that. So, you know, Machiavelli.
Damn, he saw that. I did not see it. I saw him in Home Alone 2 and didn't think twice, but you know what? Tupac saw through that. He,
I know,
saw through it.
And it's like the same people that talk about Melania and how, ooh, what's her fashion, blah, blah, blah. No, she was a part of the birther movement. Like, let's, yeah, really kind of take these people to task, because it's easy to get distracted with how fast everything moves nowadays.
Yeah.
So let's just keep
it is
our
hard
eyes on the prize. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, speaking of, you mentioned something, get out there and vote. But I've got another way that you can get involved into your democracy and why your democracy needs you. I've been doing a deep dive into my jury experience and some trials that you'll see the importance of why you serving your jury duty is so important.
All right, let's do it.
I can't hear myself, plugged in? But I'm assuming that
these are real podcast listeners, not actors.
And
hey, thanks for coming. Here's a list of descriptors. What would you choose to describe the perfect podcast?
I mean, vulgarity.
Dumb. Definitely dumb.
And like, right here, this one, meritless.
What if I told you there was a podcast that did have all of that?
No.
Jordan, Jesse, Go. And it's free.
Jordan, Jesse, Go?
Jordan, Jesse, Go.
Jordan, Jesse, Go. A real podcast.
All right, judicial system. Let's do it.
Do you know what the Sixth Amendment is?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, it's the right to, it's a pop quiz, Minority Corner style. It's a right to a trial by a fair and impartial jury of our peers. So that is
cool.
Like up there in, like, you know, the Bill of Rights are, like, the most important things that you're supposed to have as an American. And it's, like, right there in the forefront. And I think so many people do not actually have, get a fair, first of all, what statistically it's, like 97% of cases don't even go to trial, right? And then those that do go to trial, not all of them actually get a fair and impartial jury. So I was really inspired by my experience through doing jury duty. And we'll get to that a little bit later. But I want to kind of talk about just some facts that are happening nationwide about jury and jury duty. So in New York City, specifically, approximately 12% of jurors summoned each week appear to serve. So only 12% of those who have been even summoned even appear to serve. Yes, right?
Oh, wow.
Compare that to, it's about 20% nationwide. So New York is falling.
What the hell? Nobody's showing up.
So first of all, people aren't even showing up, right? And at the end, like, I have some ideas and theories about why that is happening.
Wait, I have a question, though.
Okay, yeah.
What happens if you don't show up? Like, I've always been afraid
to just... You're supposed to go to
jail. Yeah, that's what I thought. Like, I've been afraid to throw away just, oh, I got a jury summons, throw it out. No, like, I'm afraid they're going to lock me up. But apparently,
well, I think it's
80% of Americans do not give a shit.
And are not going to jail. But you know what? I think it's one of those things that, like, you could be thrown into jail. Like, it's maybe on your record, or it's, like, one of those things that, like, if they wanted to throw you in jail, they could be like, oh, and I can never show up for a jury duty. We can now arrest her.
Like, people like who have, a like, parking ticket?
Exactly. Like, people
seatbelt ticket.
Seatbelt tickets. Or, like, people who have, like, or people who have, like, warrants out for their arrests, you know? Like, if, like, people who have outstanding warrants or things like that, it's, like, a thing that they could get you on. But they're not necessarily hunting you down for it.
Well, that's not strong enough, apparently. 80% is a lot of people.
Among death row cases in North Carolina, prosecutors were 2.5 times more likely to dismiss black jurors than white jurors. This was a study in 2012. In Caddo Parish, C-A-D-D-O, Caddo. That's how I think they say it. Prosecutors were 3 times more likely to dismiss black jurors than jurors of other races, according to another study. And then a 12-person jury that reflected the racial balance of the parish would include 5 black members, and 19% of such juries were acquitted. So another analysis of 8 southern states found white-based jury selection in several jurisdictions, including Houston County, Alabama, where 26% of residents were black. But between 2005 and 2009, half of Houston County juries were all white. And the other half included only 1 black member. So, and I think there was something that I read too, that by having that 1 black member helped, I'll see if I can find the statistic, but I feel like it was something to the effect of that it helped that when there wasn't a black person on jury, and if it was a black defendant, that the, having that 1 black person helped balance the scales. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. It's like what happened when I was in college. I had a friend and another friend, I had 2 friends. And one friend told me that when I left the room, the other friend said, oh, I can say this now because Ineke is gone.
Oh, God.
And the first friend said, no, you can't. And but I think that that's what it is. You put a black person in the room and then everybody else feels like, I can't let my racist flag fly.
That show. Excuse me, sir. Something is showing. Your racism is showing. Cover it up.
It's bullshit.
This study also pointed out that that had evidence that some district attorneys' offices trained lawyers to stealthily exclude racial minorities from jury service. And I think we mentioned this, but John Oliver did a segment talking about that just a few weeks ago.
Right. Like, if you're wearing... I dismissed this guy because he was wearing a Malcolm X shirt.
Which, that was my original plan. I'm not kidding. I wore my Black Panther t-shirt. But then, I'll talk about this later, but when I saw the case, I buttoned my shirt up and I was like, nope, I'm going to be here fully. And if this is my case, I'm going to be on it. This guy needs me. And I'll tell you, I am glad I was there. Let me tell you. Although most studies of jury dismissals examine racial biases of prosecutors, it does work the other way around, too. Apparently, in one North Carolina county, defense attorneys disproportionately chose to dismiss whites, while state prosecutors disproportionately chose to dismiss blacks, according to this 1999 study. So
I wonder why.
I guess people are like aware that this bias exists, and they're just trying to stack the jury in their favor. This one comes from Florida. So juries formed from all white jury pools in Florida convicted black defendants 16% more often than white defendants.
God damn it.
So, and again, that statistic, like, you have to look at that and say, oh, that's racism. Otherwise, you do believe that black people are more guilty than white people.
Right. It's a black and white situation. There's no gray area in that.
It's the same thing when you look at the wealth gap and you see that white people make so much more money than black people. Either the system is, there's this racism happening here, or you believe that white people work harder and deserve more money than black people. Right? Like, that's... Mm-hmm. That's what those things are saying. So when you see these, it's like, ooh, this is bad.
Right.
And so...
And those are dangerous thought patterns.
Exactly.
If you know someone that has a dangerous thought pattern like that...
They're like, oh, yeah, no. White people just make more money because they're better.
That's fucked up.
Oh, black people just do more crime. That's why. That's
Black people are lazy and dangerous. No. Something is wrong here. No.
Yeah. And so going back to the statistic, this gap was nearly eliminated when at least... I found it. So this gap was nearly eliminated when at least one member of the jury pool was black, according to a Duke University-led study. Crazy, right?
Yeah, or not, because people feel...
Like you were saying, yeah.
Yeah, their conscience steps in when you have to face it. It's Yeah.
Yeah. And in cases with no blacks in the jury pool, blacks were convicted 81% of the time and whites were convicted 66% of the time.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So there's that 16% there. And then when the jury pool did include at least one black person, the conviction rates were nearly identical. 71% for black defendants and 73% for white people.
See?
So, isn't that crazy? God. Bananas.
It's also like, do you think like, because I am definitely not of the camp where it's like all white people are racist and think that way. Of course not.
Yeah.
But do you think that people get emboldened when the representation isn't there? So that one person who does have those evil thoughts will more likely speak to them when the representation is not in the room.
I do. And I think I have a study that I'm going to read a little bit later that corroborates that they did, that was talked about bias. The answer is yes. And also just on my own experience with my own trial, which I'll talk about in a sec. I do. And I'm glad that I was there because I could see how votes were falling when we had first after the trial. And just two quick examples of this. There's this guy named Timothy Foster. He was a black man who was sentenced to death row in 1987 by an all-white jury. And there was a landmark ruling in 1986 called Batson v. Kentucky, which would mean that older cases could be retried if lawyers found that the use of... preemptory strikes in racially biased ways. So if they felt that like it was like an all white jury who convicted someone based on their race, you could get the case retried down the line. So there was that case that happened in 1986. So essentially trial went back up because Foster, now he confessed that he killed this elderly white woman. But in 2006, one of Foster's attorney obtained prosecutor's notes, which showed that they highlighted the black prospective jurors' names and marked them with a B and raked them in case it came down to having to pick one of the black juries.
Ew.
Jurors, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's shady as hell. But I mean, he did confess in doing it. But still, he deserves a fair trial. We all deserve fair trials.
And that's my whole entire thing. And he did not have a fair trial. I think he had like an all-white jury and they sentenced him to, you know, death. And I'm not pro-death penalty. And I think I think he deserved a jury of his peers, you know?
Right. Because even if you are guilty of something, it comes down to sentencing as well. And sentencing plays a huge part. If you look at the discrepancy between white criminals and the crimes they commit and the sentences that they get versus criminals of color and the sentencing that they get, it's wild.
It's, yeah, way different. And so that's like, even myself, when I was in my case, I was like, I was thinking in the back of my head, I was like, what is the sentencing sort of gonna be? Does the crime fit the punishment? Was right. there even a crime? Which we'll get to you in a second. Look at all this teasing.
I know, you keep teasing this trial.
I just want to give it some other context and some other trials first. Yes. And this one came from an ex of mine sent me this, because him and I got into a healthy conversation about, because I'm very pro jury duty now, and he is a lawyer, and he's ex-lawyer, I think, and he's very, he doesn't believe in the system, and he feels it's all corrupt. And I'm like, yeah, that's why you need to do your jury duty, because the system is fucked up and needs you to tip the scales towards balance. And then right after that conversation, he sent me this Lambda Legal was sent out this article about a gay man on death row. He was guilty. He robbed the store, and this guy walked in. He got startled and killed the guy. But it's not just race where people are being having bias against them. So there's evidence that suggests at least some members of the jury accepted the notion that life in prison without parole would be fun for a gay person.
What the fuck is that?
So again, when you're talking about sentencing, that's why they wanted him to be put on to death row, because they didn't want him. He was just going to be having a gay old time in prison, sucking cocks behind bars.
Yeah, because it's just going to be like fun time, booty sex time. Like, that's not like...
That's not what prison is.
Even if you enjoy butt sex, it doesn't mean that it can still be rape. Like, fuck you, jury. That's ridiculous.
And gay men do not fare well in prison.
No. Let's face it. Nobody fares well in prison.
Yeah, that's true.
It's prison for a reason.
Yeah, but specifically, like, the gay men and transgender people get targeted in prison. So
yes.
So they felt that it was necessary for them to impose the death penalty instead.
God, what's wrong? Because they knew that he was gay.
And during jury deliberations, the jury sent. So you can send, when you're in deliberations, you can send notes to the judge asking for clarification or questions, or to see certain evidence pieces again, and they sent a note indicating his being gay was a hot topic in their deliberations, essentially. Like, what? why does that have to do with anything about
that
the crime?
Has nothing to do with anything.
So the note asked whether if he was sentenced to life without parole, would he be allowed to mix with the general inmate population?
What?
Would he be able to brag about his crimes to other inmates, especially new and or young men? And or
See,
would
okay,
he be able
you-
to enjoy conjugal visits? Like, where is your mind going?
You
were supposed to be
this-
talking about the case and the fact. Like, why are you thinking about
this? Is like gossip town. This
oh
is like
God,
they're sending
right.
a note to the judge. They're like, do you want to go get lunch after this, judge? Hey, judge, what do you think about this last week of scandal? Like, and this is going along with my theory before.
Yes.
I feel like if there is one gay person in that room, or at least a fucking ally,
yes.
to say...
Hold up. This is not the conversation.
No, Harold. Yes, right. Why do you keep bringing this up? Because you know it's one person.
Yes,
it's
right.
one person that is leading that shit.
Yes.
That's bullying the jury into thinking some fucking biased ways. And nobody is strong enough to go up against it.
You
like,
are so
that
right.
is the biggest problem to me. Because it's somebody with a toxic person on the jury can... kill somebody.
Yep, absolutely.
Essentially.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so again, like, they just kept bringing up his, like, homosexuality, and then he ended up he's on death row because of this, and so they're trying to re-bring
Ridiculous.
Up again because of that, what is that, 1986 Bastin v. Kentucky case.
Good.
They're trying to get this retried, and like you said, you're so right, because I, again, am teasing it, but it only takes one person to turn a jury in a negative direction, but turn it in a positive one.
Yeah, that's good.
I want to circle back to, you mentioned something about bias earlier,
yeah.
and if that has, and how that might play. And so Samuel R. Somers and Phoebe C. Ellsworth of the University of Michigan, they did a thing where they gauged how and when racism manifests in white jurors. So what they did is they had 196 randomly selected white folks, And they had written accounts of an interracial assault between basketball team players. And half of the summaries featured a white defendant and a black victim. The other half described a plaintiff as white and the accused as black. So they had switched it.
Okay.
So then half the summaries included language about the defendant's cultural isolation and subjugation to racial remarks and unfair criticism by his teammates, and all included details of the defendant's height, age, and weight so that the mock jurors wouldn't be able to deduce and figure out what the study was doing. So they're trying to switch it up on them so they wouldn't
So just to be clear, they kept everything the same except for the race. They switched it.
Yes, right, yeah. Okay, but they made sure to also not just talk about just their race. They also talked about, like, their height, their age. Right. That way the jury's not like, oh, they're trying to see if I'm racist or not. Like,
yeah, exactly.
So they fooled them.
Trying to be sly. It was a good study.
You know what? You got to, because people are up on this, right? And some I think, actually, this study was done in 2001. So this is really... So 2001. When race was a leading issue, the defendants were convicted at similar rates. When they talked about race when it was a leading issue, they convicted the defendants at similar rates. But when race was not at the forefront, however, 90% of the white jurors chose to convict the black defendant compared to with a 70% conviction rate for the white defendant. So
like,
when you blatantly say and play, quote unquote,
nobody wants to be a full on racist.
Exactly.
No one wants to be like, oh, I'm not a racist. But then when it's sly, that's when your racist tendencies pop up.
Mm-hmm. So in trials, if they make it about race, then people will try to like not be that. But when it's not there, their bias goes unchecked. They don't feel like they have to check that bias, and it's just running rampant. Yeah.
This is so annoying.
So this brings me to the trial that I was on. So the defendant, it was the cops versus a very, very dark skinned black man. Very, very dark skinned black man.
That's important. We have to just say, I do have to say that it's important to talk about skin tone.
Yes.
Because that plays a huge part on the perception of black people.
I just corroborating what you're saying, and I knew that, Aneke, and that's why I saw that guy, and I don't really know his backstory, but he kind of looks like down, like nothing, he's down and out, nothing real that fancy, you know,
he's a dude.
He's a guy living in New York, just, you know, doesn't, maybe down on his luck, I knew what his perception was, and because, I'm also processing that information, but I'm also like, how are these other folks processing the information?
Right.
I was the only, this is New York City, I was the only black person, black male on my jury.
Wait, were there black women?
There was a woman who I believe she was Southeast Asian. There was a guy who was Middle Eastern. Two guys, another guy was Southeast Asian, and I believe a Latina and a woman who she might be Afro Caribbean. I'm not sure. So there's about five POCs there, right?
And one black woman. Possibly.
Possibly black woman. Yeah. And again, but two, like also, so they pick 12 jurors and then four alternates as well who also have to be there. Everybody else is, you know, pretty much white.
That's shitty to be an alternate. Just, you know.
Because you have to sit there and like.
And not do anything. Ew.
Yes. So I got, like, I right away got cast as juror number one.
Yes, actor.
I was the first to go, like, and give, like, my spiel about, they ask you all these questions of, like, who are you? What do you do? And, like, they have this paper that you read, and I just did, like, a monologue song and dance number. And then, like, the judge was like, now, we don't all expect you to be as good as Mr. Martin here. And I was like, oh my God.
You were feeling that.
Oh, my God. And then I was cast. I was like, yeah, I was the first person to go up and speak, and I was the first person to get cast, and I was the only person to have two speaking parts too, which I won't tell you what those lines were yet.
We know what those lines are. Anybody watch the legal drama?
Well,
we know who juror number one is, James.
Okay, fair enough. And so he was being charged of wielding a weapon to be used unlawfully to induce harm, and then another charge of wielding a weapon to be used, So those are the charges. So you're like, oh my God, what'd this guy do, right?
So like, I'm imagining him swinging a bat at somebody.
Aneke, if only. So let me tell you this. Now, The DA, district attorney, so I learned a lot. Now, the defense doesn't actually have to prove anything. It's all on the prosecution has to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that the defendant is guilty. They have to bring the evidence. They have to give opening statements. The defense doesn't actually technically have to do any of that. So it's all in the prosecutors. Yeah. So, which I really do love about our system, that you are innocent until proven guilty. So they have, that guy's innocent. Look at that man. He's innocent. But Anika, I know for a fact that people were not looking at this man like he was innocent. I know
of
that.
Of course not. I mean, you have a, let's just face it. You put a black guy, you say that he was wielding a something to cause harm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You just imagine him swinging a pipe at somebody. You know, like it could be anything. Like if it's causing harm, you imagine a pipe, a bat, a branch,
a chainsaw, something.
Some chains. I don't know.
Let me tell you about what these weapons were, Aneke.
Okay.
So they found on his person. So they had three people testifying against the defendant, and the defendant also doesn't have to testify.
Was somebody hurt though? Was somebody actually hurt?
Well, let me walk you through this whole entire thing.
Okay, sorry.
So here's apparently what happened, that there was this guy who, apparently the defendant, like, cut this guy on the hand, but the guy who was injured wasn't even there to testify. He wasn't gonna-
Why wasn't he there?
He wasn't there.
He was just like, don't want to do this.
So there's a lot of questions of like, why wasn't he really there? So again, like it's again reminding you, the prosecutor's job is to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt, to be able to prove the facts. So they essentially have to add 1 + 1 + 1 has to equal 3. They can't do 1 + 1. That doesn't equal 3.
I mean, I'm already starting to doubt if the dude wasn't even there.
Right?
Because if somebody was swinging a chain at me, I would be there. I'd be that guy swung a chain at me.
I gotta tell you what the weapon was. They found on his person a box cutter.
Okay, does he work for UPS?
That wasn't brought up, but the box cutter, but here's the thing. And then they found in the vicinity down the sewers, they kept calling it another box cutter, but it wasn't. It was a pocket knife. So they found it in the sewers in the vicinity, and
that
then
could
they tried
be anybody.
I know, and they tried to say it was his, and like
this
in that case, they
whack.
Don't even look alike. So it's not even like they're a matching set. So apparently,
what do we have? Box cutter in one hand and this mysterious pipe, this other thing in his other hand.
The box cutter was in his pocket, and the other quote unquote box cutter that they found, which was not a box cutter, it was a hand pocket knife. They found it down some sewer gutter, so they had to search and find this. So what happened was, I guess, this guy. So there was two officers who, like, there's an officer who was up there on the giving his testimony first. Right. And the way that he described it, he was like, the quote unquote, I don't like to say victim because the guy was coming up and he was just bleeding all over the place. And you would expect they're going to show the knife and it was going to be covered in blood. They showed a picture of it, and the defense showed a picture of it. So not even the prosecution. The prosecution did not show a picture of it. The defense showed a picture of it, and it had some sort of like red mark on the tip. And that's about
it.
And this happened a year later, but still,
this was a year ago.
And they had time to run forensics on this, and they didn't. They didn't.
What?
They didn't run. So there's no DNA proof of it, and they weren't even trying to say that the box cutter found on him. They weren't even trying to say that he had used it in the attack. They were trying to say he could have used it because they're trying to prove that the first one was used on this person.
This guy has been waiting a year to go on trial for cutting a man on the hand with a box cutter.
But which we don't even actually. And here's the thing. So they had video.
Supposedly.
And then they had video footage outside of the gentleman's club. And what you see is. Look, get that bias out of here, Aneke. You're supposed to be fair and impartial.
I'm one of the four alternates. I don't gotta do shit. I'm just sitting here waiting for one of you guys to get sick. Call me understudy.
Oh my god. Footage shows, and they brought like the manager of the gentleman's club to corroborate that this was in fact, it was
ooh,
so silly.
Spicy. Spicing up the trial.
Yes. Because the DA had no case in Eke. So they were trying to bring
obviously.
Out who they
obviously.
And so they bring her and they're like, is this the video footage
ooh, it's
outside?
A lady.
Yeah. They're like, is this the video footage outside the club? She's like, yeah. And they're like, okay, thank you. And
that's
like,
it. It was
so
this
silly.
Is stupid.
Tax dollars at work.
This is a waste of tax dollars.
And okay, so
they need to be putting this towards the fucking Harlem Arts program. This is annoying as
those
hell.
Those kids need it. And I'm there with my notes, trying to take notes and really trying to change someone's life. And so, so what happens is they show the video footage and it's kind of mm-hmm. choppy, but you can see. So the defendant is, there's a guy yelling at him across the street and then he's yelling at him. The guy comes over across the street, pushes the defendant, then the defendant pushes him, and then the defendant runs away off camera.
So that's it.
That's what you see. It happens, and so then the next thing that we hear is that the police say, "Oh, then the guy who got cut like comes running up to them, and he's all bleeding, and he says,
this guy isn't,
he cut me, he stabbed me, and then they arrest the black guy because the other guy was lighter skin toned." Think he was
so he was a black guy too.
No. He had a Latin last name. It was like Vasquez. So they took.
He could have been black. He could have been. He could have been Afro Latino. He could have been Latino.
Sure. Yeah. And he was very, but he was very much lighter skinned. And because I think it has impact because this other guy was very, very dark. And I'm just saying that to like to it's you get what I'm
colorism
saying.
Colorism is a thing.
It's a thing. It's a thing. And so the defense, like again, like I was so glad that this defense attorney was so dope. Aneke, I'm so grateful because you hear shitty things about defense attorneys that they're really overworked. But this guy,
exactly.
like. He really cared. He's an older guy. Like he's in the game. He is doing the work. I'm just so grateful that he had this guy. And so there was no case.
I'm glad I wasn't on that jury because I would have been like, this is stupid.
So
I
why did
like,
we?
This is dumb.
Well,
this
I
is
wish
stupid.
You
stupid.
I wish you would have been because then we went back to deliberate and Aneke.
Yes, what happened?
So I'm the jury foreman, so like I get to pass notes. I get to be a secret high school lovers with a judge, so I get to pass notes to the judge. It's a real thing.
Were you like, hey, what's going on later?
So we go in there and I just immediately, because I remember, what do they do on The People versus OJ? I remember, what you do is you go in there and you take an initial just sort of vote, like an anonymous vote. And so that's what I had us do. And
look at you.
I thought it was going to be clear cut. Like, Aneke, I was like, there's no case. Even the judge,
because this is dumb.
When the DA rested his case, the judge was like, "Oh, that's it." I thought we're gonna do another a full day of
testimony. The judge
testimony.
Straight up said, "That's it."
He was sort of shocked and surprised. And what I think here's my theory of what happened. I think that this and one of the cops didn't even remember what happened. He was like, "Oh, I don't really remember." He was like, "It was a year ago." Because he was like the
this
sergeant.
Is garbage.
So
this
I think,
guy has been in jail for a year waiting trial.
And also, I think this goes to something that Boots Riley was talking about when that, like, we have to be careful that, like, because the cop who was like, oh, there was blood everywhere, and this was like his, you know, his case against, he had arrested the guy, he had, you know, filled out the paperwork and all the charges.
Yeah.
But he was Southeast Asian. And so, but I think that there's a bias that just runs rampant, that the bias in the police department knows no bounds. I think it's a cultural thing that happens within the police departments. Because
all races, even black cops,
absolutely. Because Boots Riley took to task the main character in Black Klansman, that, you know, he's kind of glorified in Black Klansman, but like he was also infiltrating like you know, Black Panther groups and trying to
so he was doing it all.
He was doing
not
it all,
telling the whole story.
Yeah, so he was kind of side eyeing Spike Lee for not telling the whole entire story. So
omitting some truths, and I agree with that.
Yeah. So we go in there and we take an initial vote, and I couldn't believe it that we weren't all in favor that on both of those counts, not guilty. So on the first one, and I think people were a little bit confused, but like I was pretty much like I knew it was like, oh, these white people have definitely voted.
So what did they say? They thought that he was guilty?
I think people were just confused on, like, again, the charge was wielding a weapon to be okay. used unlawfully to induce harm. So it's essentially three things have to be true. So he has to be wielding a weapon. So you have to right. first think that that was a weapon. He then has to be using it unlawfully and then to then induce harm. And and not, like, here's the thing. Anyone can define what a weapon is. I could say my headphones are a weapon. And
right,
then
if you use it as such.
And then unlawfully, it is actually not against the law to defend yourself. And what did we see in that video footage? He got pushed first.
He was defending himself.
And we also don't actually know how the guy got cut. He could have cut himself. We don't know. We never actually see. And so here's the thing is that the defense, not the the prosecutors didn't prove their case. So that was their job. Wow. And now we have all this doubt in our head. So that's it. Yeah. So then we kind of went back and forth and we were talking about it. But then there was this one guy who was holding out.
Here we go.
This one guy, he was this, you know, Jewish guy who just, he said things like this, Aneke. Well, it's illegal to lie to the cops. So why would the first guy who said he caught me, he wouldn't lie to the cops.
What?
Right? Like, that's really cute. That is really cute that you think that people don't lie to the cops. That is, like, really, really adorable because... That's no. And
people
so then you're saying
lie to the cops all the time.
And so then when the black guy is saying I didn't do it, oh, he's lying? Like what?
Right. So you're saying you rather believe the guy wouldn't lie to the cop versus this other guy lying on oath.
Yeah.
And then, that's crazy. People in the moment are more likely to lie to to a cop's face than when they're on trial to lie.
Yep.
Like
yeah.
Why is this guy sticking to his gun? Racism?
And okay, we're all ready to go home. Like, we all, like, we talked about it. We deliberated. Some of the white people came around. They're like, oh, I was confused about the charges. Oh, you're right. After hearing you talk, like, I get it. This, you know, they see it. But then, like, and, like, the second knife that they had found, Aneke, in the vicinity was the only one that they had even said could have been used in the altercation, right?
So they're saying the box cutter couldn't have even been used.
And he doesn't think that the second one was used, but he thinks the box cutter. He's trying to convict him on the first one. But they never said it was used. And Aneke, I'm just looking at him and I'm just like, your bias is weighing so heavily on your heart. I can see it. Like, you're stuck in your racism. You are stuck
and
in your racism.
This is such a bad hill to die on. Like, if it was way more gray or way more foggy or way more like let's say they got into a shoving match and then they actually tumbled and ended up on the ground.
Sure.
Then there's more of a chance that he could have cut him. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it takes somebody to be really skilled to be like, pull out their pocket knife or their box cutter, slash somebody really quickly within the frame of a push for the other guy to go running to yell at the fucking police. Like, die on your hill over your cause if there is wiggle room. This guy is like, I don't understand why people have to defend their bias so hard. And that's what I don't understand.
I was staring in his soul and I could see it. I'm like, oh, but you can't see it. But I see it. Your racism is showing. And like, here's the other thing too, is that the defendant was the one running towards the cops. So if he cuts, and like, they were in a huge van, and the defense attorney made a point to, like, when he was cross-examining, he's like, how big was the van? Could the van be visible? Like, and then made the conclusion, like, if he did cut someone, why would he run towards the police?
Right. Oh, so the guy ran towards the police too?
He ran towards the police. He was being chased by the other guy. And then
the other guy said he cut me and they arrested him.
And then they found some other random knife in the sewers and was like, that's his too. Look, there's some red stuff on it. Oh, that's
stupid.
Blood.
Stupid.
Well, I think what happened was this was a bullshit case and that...
They arrested him and they didn't want to have to deal with the repercussions of a false arrest.
Exactly. And so they gave it to this, and the prosecutor, he was sort of like, he was young. They gave it to this young DA who they knew it was going to be a shit case, but they're like, well, at least we have to try it. But like, here's the thing is that what makes me nervous is that I was so grateful that I was on that jury because Aneke,
That guy would have persuaded them the other way.
It could have gone in a different direction. So it goes back to like what you were talking about, how the power of like one person. You were absolutely right. And that, yeah, like, again, this trial never made a point to talk about race, but I knew that what was happening.
Yeah, duh.
And so, and remember, when you don't talk about race deliberately, it allows people's biases to go unchecked.
You know what? And this really, it's like, one, the bias, let's just say, you know, you weren't on that trial and Mr. Lie to the Police weirdo, mm-hmm, sway the jury to convict this guy and he's in jail.
Yep.
That's yet another easy way for a black man to go to jail.
Yep.
Like, not to mention he's been in jail for a year.
Yeah.
Over shoving.
Yep.
Like, that's what it boils down to. He, yep, was on the street. He yelled at somebody. Another person yelled at him. They got into a shoving match. And then he's in jail for a year.
Yep.
None of us regular folk could even handle being in jail for a week, let alone a month. Unfathomable for a year while he's waiting for a trial over shoving.
Yep.
Like, this is disgusting to me. Like we've been laughing and kicking about it, like, but the truth of the matter is, this is a crime.
Yeah.
The fact that he even had to spend a year in jail,
yeah,
like, that, even if he cut this dude with a box cutter, I would even say his year in jail is enough for that.
Yeah,
like,
you've done, oh, what? Sorry, you had to wait in there for
enough.
A year. Yeah, you're fine, you're okay. Yeah, I absolutely, I agree with everything that you just said there. And yeah, and just, it's,
I'm just thinking about fucking Michael Jackson and the Beat It video where they like tie their arms together and they have the fucking knife fight. They didn't even do that.
Nope. Wasn't even.
Shoves.
Wasn't even up to that scale or that level. And I think it just goes back to like the importance of, also, like, I knew this guy. I had a feeling that he was probably innocent because, like, you know, the DA probably threw plea bargains at him, but this guy knew,
yeah,
he, like, to before them to even go to trial, because remember, only like 97% of cases don't even go to trial because the DA will say, well, here's a plea bargain, you can do, mm-hmm, this much time, and usually people take that time because they're so afraid of being convicted,
right,
for longer sentences. So this guy,
exactly,
knew he didn't do it. So there's already, again, innocent until proven guilty. And like, I just, mm-hmm, made me so sad that people didn't go in with that same sort of you know, thinking.
Mentality.
And it's all the more important reason to, like, you know, I, and
it's,
here's,
true,
the thing, I was the only black person on that trial, on that jury, on the only black man.
Mm-hmm.
And I also get it of like why probably a lot of POCs get out of their jury duty, because the wealth income gap, you know,
right,
they're,
you,
like,
can't afford to take jobs, time off of work.
Right. So that's also, look how much all these systems are so intertwined and come into play, which is why it's,
oh,
like,
it's awful.
Allies, white folks, y'all go do, woke ass white people, go do your fucking jury duty. Like,
yeah,
I
really
can't,
like, pay attention to the person in the room that's trying to sway it towards a negative bias aspect and try and counteract that. Don't just go along with it so you can get out of there, because somebody's life is
yes,
in your hands.
Yep. And that's the thing too. I saw so many people who were just like, you know, they're like, oh, would you be able to, you know, be on a trial with that is about cops fairly? And so many people were like, nope, I can't. I get it. You have a mistrust for the cops. You get in, mm-hmm, line. But like, just because you have a mistrust, I was able to go there and I knew what my biases were. So I knew what deck of cards I was playing with. Just because you, mm-hmm, have a bias doesn't mean it's just going to run rampant. I believe,
yeah,
that you are smart enough to be able to hold yourself in check. Look at the facts and be an unfair, impartial jury member and see.
Right.
And you've listened to the case. They did not have, there were no, the facts weren't there. It was easy to say not guilty.
What a dumb case. I can't get over that. I can't get over it.
I was also upset. Our tax dollars at work, that they let this go to, I couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe it.
What the fuck? That's like, that's criminal to me. Like, those cops should have been on trial.
Yeah. They, yeah,
why are
absolutely.
You wasting our time?
And
why,
like,
are you wasting our time with this shit?
He just knew that they had just like wrongfully arrested a guy, and they looked at him and they looked at the other guy and were like, oh, that guy's guilty, got it, mm-hmm, and then built a case around it, and that guy, like, we like helped change this guy's life. He's out, like, he's not in prison anymore.
Good.
And like, I get it, like, and like you said, Aneke, when you're at your jury duty, listen to the trial, because I get it, if it's some bullshit where it's like, you know,
yeah,
some lady slipped to Equinox, I get it. You don't,
yeah,
want to give your life to that. Like,
I mean, like, I also, like, I had a friend who did jury duty where it was a discussion over who pressed the brake, like, during a traffic stop. And I was like, that sounds awful.
Yeah.
So, yeah, listen to the trial.
Listen to the trial. But, you know, we talk about we want to live in a democracy. Like, this is part of democracy, and democracy takes work. So I think there's other things aside from just voting is great and really amazing. But, like, this is part of our civic duty. And we're so fortunate to live in a country where you're innocent till proven guilty. Not every country has that, and not every time period would allow Black or women or gays or LGBT folks to be able to even serve on a jury. So do it with pride, get on there, and change someone's life.
Man, seriously.
Beloved Maximum Fun Star Trek podcast, The Greatest Generation, is going out on tour.
We are bringing Greatest Gen Con to a bunch of cities in the U.S. and Canada. It's our big tribute to / send-up of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. And we have a big leg coming up.
Yes, we are raising our legs on a number of cities in the coming weeks.
We're going to Washington, D.C. on August 23rd, the Bell House in Brooklyn, New York on August 24th, Mass Mocha in North Adams, Massachusetts on August 25th, Pittsburgh on the 28th, Boston, Massachusetts at the Wilbur Theater on the 29th, Atlanta, Georgia at the Earl on the 30th, Ferndale, Michigan at the Magic Bag on the 31st.
Those are some great big rooms and some great big cities, Ben.
And it's a really fun show. It's accessible. Even if you haven't listened to the podcast yet.
We can't wait to see you when we're out on tour. Check greatestgencon.com for dates and ticketing information.
And Khan is spelled K-H-A-N because Wrath of Khan, greatestgen.com.
A naked land, a naked land. She's queen of it.
It's
a naked land.
I know.
That's your new theme song.
I don't mind it. I like a good, you know, naked land, my world.
It's my world. I can do what I want.
I know. Okay, so I'm going to do a little history corner.
I love history corner.
It's a really quick, simple one. So when you think about tennis and Black women, what's the name that pops to mind?
Serena Williams, Venus Williams.
And
Serena Jr.
There we go. Exactly. So this is why I wanted to talk about this woman, because all we do is think about a Serena, and obviously Serena and Venus are like, duh.
Yes.
They're the best.
Yeah.
They're current. They're now. They're heroes. We love them. They're dominating. But who paved the way for them? I'll tell you who. Althea Gibson. Okay. So, Althea Gibson, she was the first Black person to win Wimbledon Championship 60 years ago in 1957. Oh, well,
what?
61 years ago now. 61
years ago. Oh, damn. Extra little year there.
I know.
And I think that's bananas. Mm-hmm. I never heard of her, didn't know.
Exactly.
That's crazy.
She is fucking bomb. And she was also the first person of color to win the French Open as well.
Damn.
I know. She was fucking cool. So, okay. So, basically, Althea Gibson, she became the first Black person, and I really want to highlight the fact that it's not just woman, it's Black person,
because
a lot of people bring up Arthur Ashe, and like I generally thought Arthur Ashe was the first like Black tennis person out there, but when I read this story I was happy to hear that not only that there was somebody before Arthur Ashe, but there was a Black woman. It was a Black woman, Althea Gibson. Okay, so she was the first Black person to win a major international tennis competition. In 1957, women's singles, Althea Gibson, she won the United Kingdom's Wimbledon, and she was the first Black victor at the world's oldest tennis tournament. I didn't know that Wimbledon was the world's oldest tennis tournament, so that's fascinating.
I didn't know that either. Look at us learning all kinds of corners here.
I know. So, okay, so Gibson won her Wimbledon title in two straight sets, or victories, where the same person wins every set or a subdivision of a full match. All you tennis people will understand that. And she won it against fellow American Darlene Hard. So the cool thing is, actually, her and Darlene Hard work together, too. So it's kind of sad that she won against a friend, but she competed. She won Wimbledon's women's doubles with Darlene Hard.
Oh, so that's awesome. Yeah, so they got to like join forces.
Exactly. So
good for them.
She won by herself, and then she also won together with Darlene Hard, which is also awesome. Okay, so she, along with her Wimbledon win, she also won two single victories at the French Open in 1956 and the U.S. Nationals, which is the precursor to the U.S. Open, in 1958. And that made her the first Black athlete to earn any of those titles.
That's crazy. And this is like in the 50s before this, like this is pre-civil rights like movement.
This is during, you know, civil rights movement, you know? Right.
Yeah. Yeah, like, totally.
There's like hella segregation happening.
Right. So, oh man, that's fascinating.
Just to kind of add on to her wins of all of those, you know, competitions that I told you about, she won singles and doubles in all those competitions. And she also won competitions in the Australian Open between 1956 and 1959. So she was fucking doing it. She was fucking Serena-ing it up before Serena was even a twinkle in her parents' eye at that point. Were her parents even born at that point?
I don't even know. They weren't even thinking about tennis or no babies
they
at that
were
point.
Not. Like, they were babies themselves if they were alive. So
paving the wave. Icon. Yeah. What an icon. A tennis icon.
So just to kind of add on to just to give you the climate and how she really did pave the way, Gibson, Althea Gibson, frequently encountered racist exclusions on her journey to the top. So it took fellow tennis star Alice Marble to create a petition to the United States Lawn Tennis Association to let Gibson play in the 1950s U.S. Nationals. So, like, literally, they weren't even letting her play. So it took an ally, Alice Marble, who was a tennis star, but, you know, a white tennis star, to be like, look, let this woman play. She's a talent. So if they didn't even let her play the U.S. Nationals in 1950, she wouldn't have been able to qualify for Wimbledon, the Australian Open, the French Open, and the U.S. Nationals, which turned into the U.S. Open. So that opened the door for her to basically knock down all of these barriers for all international competitions in tennis. So
she just swatting them doors down with her racket. She's like, swat, 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 swat,
doing it. So Althea Gibson was voted into the Hall of Fame in 1971. And then 9 years before, she became one of the Women's Sports Hall of Fame inaugural inductees. So she got her you know, stars as well. And she went on to also play golf.
Yeah, like at the height of her career.
Like, I think in 1959, when she was winning the Australian Open and stuff, she was like, you know what, I'm going to play golf. And then she decided to be a fucking bomb at golf as well. So that's,
she's like a Michael Jordan, Bo Jackson before even they were even a twinkle in someone's womb.
Doing it all.
Scrotum. Yeah.
So I just want to tip my hat to Althea Gibson for being a fucking awesome Black woman tennis player, and one that we don't even think about when you think about tennis. Like, there's so many different, like, we think about Serena, we think about Venus, we think about Battle of the Sexes that happened in the 70s. There was a movie made over Battle of the Sexes.
Right.
But we don't think about Althea Gibson. So let's give her a movie, because I'm sure that would be fucking fascinating as well.
That'd be amazing, cause especially because, like you said, it's a story that nobody knows about. And we're like, oh, look at this forgotten history that is actually really important because it paved the way for all these other people that are here now.
Exactly. So, Althea Gibson, thank you. A backswing to you.
Or, like, what is it? A love to you.
Yeah, because love means something in tennis. It's like a game match. I should know this. I spent so many years on the court, but it just went in one ear and out there. I'm not
look
good.
Look at you.
I'm terrible.
I only played that jungle tennis.
What's jungle tennis?
You just hit the ball wherever you can. And there's just
wild times just hitting it?
Wild times. My PE teacher used to be like, he was like, none of that jungle tennis over
that
there.
Sounds like
now
it
that
could
I think
be
about
racist.
It, that could be racist.
That sounds racist as hell.
Wow, I just discovered that.
I
you you know what?
I can't believe a teacher literally called it jungle tennis.
And you know what? We were the minority kids because we were always in the corner.
Ew!
So.
Well, huh, we just unearthed something.
I discovered that. I did not know that. That's like, I just had therapy with you just now,
I know.
Okay?
You know what you should have said? I wish you could go back in time and be like, say that to Althea Gibson.
Yeah, and bring her, and she'd be like, I'm going to show you how to play, honey.
Actually,
I'm a,
yeah.
you know,
how
Wimbledon
come your teacher
winner.
Wasn't actually teaching you how to play tennis?
Because, again, the PE teachers weren't doing shit at my school. They were like,
this
okay,
podcast,
now go play with these balls.
We're learning a lot
go
about
run
your
over here.
Upbringing.
Yeah, my PE was very traumatizing, apparently, in high school for me. They didn't do shit. Did they teach you how to do stuff in your PE class?
Kind of, but I got out of it because nice. I did a lot of extracurricular other nerdo things because I'm not sporty. I once was told that I sashayed down the court when I played basketball, so let's start
well,
there.
I would like to see that.
Let's
someone,
start there.
Bringing silent pizzazz to the court. Move over, Cheryl Swoops. Aneka's got your sachet away.
I won't catch anything, and I won't make any hoops.
But you'll look good doing it. This is it. This
yeah.
is it.
We finished. Okay, so I don't have a tweet of the week.
Oh.
Our Twitter is Minority Corner. Remember, corner is spelt with a K.
You could be the tweet of the week next week. It could be you.
I know, you could be. You should tweet us something. But I do want to read this one tweet that I found, and a lot of people were retweeting, and I think it's good for all of us to hear.
Mm.
It is from @GorillaMemoir, and it starts off, Toni Morrison, 40. Mark Twain, 41. Marcel Proust, 43. Henry Miller, 44. J.R.R. Tolkien, 45. I'm going to skip some. Laura Ingalls Wilder, 65. Harriet Dewar, 74. Harry Bernstein, 96. No, you are not too old to publish your first book.
Nice.
I really want to put that out there because I feel like a lot of us feel like, oh, I'm too old to do this. I'm too old to do that. You're never too old to do anything unless it's like, you know, join the Olympic gymnastics team. But you
there's
never
some
know,
dreams
but
you
I'm
might
saying,
need to like pass up on. You're right.
But I do want to put that out there and just, you know, really try not to let age be a barrier into what you're trying to do and what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah.
Like, don't let what people say, don't let other people's perceptions cloud your way. You only get one life. Do it.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I have to keep telling myself. And, you know, that list is so encouraging to me. You
yeah.
know, like, Toni Morrison didn't publish her first book until she was 40. What?
Right.
So I just thought that was great.
I feel you on that too. Like, it's like, I think we, I too, like, in, like, as an actor, sometimes look at like people's IMDb pages and I'm like, okay, how old were they when they did their first like walk on role in some shitty TV show? Like, you
right.
know, because we put so much pressure on, there's such like ageism in our culture and that there's such a thing
yeah.
towards like, you know, youth, but like, it's never too late. Like, I did have to retire on my dream of being a backup dancer for Janet Jackson. Like, it's probably not going to happen, but it's,
you never know though.
At least one dream can allow me, but you know what? I could have gotten picked to be on that stage and dance. They were picking people from the audience, so it almost
it's
happened.
True. It's true. I never know. And she's 50.
52.
So
52.
52.
Yes.
So, I mean, come on. Like,
and just being,
they're still doing it.
Yeah,
yeah.
And just being fabulous as ever, working it out. Like, that's such like goals. I'm like, oh my God, I'm 52. Let me be doing that sort of shit. But I thank you for reading that list. That is so true. Never too late. Keep living your best
right.
life.
And a lot of those names are legends, like J.R.R. Tolkien.
I know
like,
him.
I mean,
he wrote that
like,
book.
Like, come on, Lord of the Rings. Like,
yeah.
that's humongous. This is legendary stuff. And he was 45 when he published his first book. So just keep pursuing what you want to do. And if somebody calls you, like, old, then they need to shut the fuck up.
I hope they're not your friend, because you need to reevaluate your friends list. And if they're your family,
exactly.
you need to have a good talking to. And you know what? They probably have some, like, they have some dreams that they wish they were
their
pursuing.
Own insecurities.
So
a lot of people look at the world through their own prism of their own insecurities. So just separate yourself from that.
Mm. I love this like little a super soul bumper that we did at the end here.
Yeah, just you know,
great.
Just a little bit of wicker chair sitting underneath this oak tree linen pants
yes.
kind of discussion.
I will say, speaking of wicker chair, I. Mm-hmm. Like Janet's performance on Jimmy Fallon, she's sitting on one of those African wicker chairs in the
Ooh,
very
I
beginning.
I love it. Those are great.
It's like Wakanda African like fusion. It's all
Black Panther.
It's all there, and I love like the new sound of music is like going more Afro-Caribbean sound. So it's just
it's like. It's a fun world music mix.
It is, yeah. So I can listen to it.
In the video, she like was really combining all of different fabrics from around the world, which I really want to start embracing. Like, I think that could be a cool trend that we can go into, is like using different textiles from around the world and like in a hip, fashionable way.
Yeah, I agree. She's always one to sort of set the page. She's not looking at what all the other young kids are doing. She's like, what do I want to do? She's like,
exactly.
I'm making the mark here. This is what we're doing. Black and beautiful, you know, Caribbean and beautiful, like Afro-Latino and beautiful. So beautiful. Mm-hmm. Well, Aneka, I had a great time hanging out with you today at the corner.
This was awesome.
You can,
but it's always awesome.
Yeah, it's true. You can hang out with us in the Minority Corner Kids Playground. Said it right this
time. Yes, yeah, you did. That's on Facebook. You should join. I want to bring up that we're on Spotify, which I just found out is kind of. We're part of a rare club. There's not a lot of podcasts that are on Spotify.
Yeah, it was exclusive. Kinda... We got an exclusive invite, so we're there too.
You can. Click on that. Listen away there.
And
that's exciting.
Don't forget to write a review for us on the iTunes. It helps other people find us as well. We're at 5 stars right now. Yeah. So thanks, everybody.
So thank you. Yeah. Keep thank you going. Guys who have written reviews. That's fucking awesome. Thank you guys for listening too. Jeez.
Yeah. Y'all are so wonderful. We love spending time with you each and every week.
The best.
Thank you for listening to Minority Corner.
Because together,
we're the majority. Nailed it.
Bye.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.